ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays on ABC Radio National.
Global events, well, they're coming too thick and fast.
We're delivering 5 days a week.
The issues, the challenges are serious, but our aim always is to make it a conversation we can all share. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Global Roaming.
Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Among the many problems facing the government are two enormous ones. It's spending too much compared to what it earns. It's forecasting deficits as far as the eye can see. And it isn't even close to meeting its commitments to cut carbon emissions. As things stand, it'll miss its targets in 2030, 2035, and 2050. What if there was a way out of both problems that also allowed it to hand out cash and gave it funds to spare? At its core would be a carbon tax, an idea the new Superpower Institute has just refined and put back into public circulation. Yes, we voted against a carbon tax once in an election 13 years ago. But we also voted against a goods and services tax once and then embraced it when the times changed. Have the times changed yet? Enough? Welcome to this very special edition of The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and my guests, Ingrid Burford, who helped develop the new proposal at the Superpower Institute and is here to sketch it out, and Ben Potter, who's contributing editor at The Energy, a news site devoted to analysing exactly these things. Welcome back, Ingrid, and welcome back, Ben.
Oh, thank you for having me again, Peter.
Yes, likewise, Peter. Pleasure to be here. Looking forward to it.
Ingrid, if anyone wants to know what the Superpower Institute is, I can think of no better place than the program we broadcast at the beginning of this year with both of you, in fact, on January 1. You'll find it in your podcast feed. What I want to ask you about today is this new proposal for a carbon tax. But before that, I want to know how bad things really are on the emissions front. Can this be right, that we're nowhere near meeting any of our targets?
To meet our targets, we need much faster rates of emission reduction than we're achieving with current policies. The Climate Change Authority has pointed out that to meet our 2030 targets, we need to more than double the rate of emissions reductions compared to the last 5 years, and more than triple the rate of reduction if we're going to land our 2035 targets. So we will need new policies if we're going to meet our international obligations.
Does this matter? In other words, will this hurt us if we do not keep global temperature increases to 1.5 degrees?
I think it's fair to say that not only will it hurt us, it already is. So we already experience the significant costs and threats from global warming, but they'll get worse as temperatures rise. It's estimated that by 2050, the cumulative cost of reduced productivity will reach over $200 billion for the Australian economy.
And these are very real costs for people. In other words, this is people needing to move locations, no longer live in places that'll be flooded, people dying of heat. These are extremely real costs which we will face if the world does not get to net zero by 2050.
Oh, absolutely. These are costs people experience at the personal level as well as the cost that we measure with numbers when we're thinking about the economy.
Ben, I'm wondering if we're being misled. If we're a long way, not even halfway there, on the trajectory from meeting our commitments to reduce emissions, we're sort of getting the impression that it's in hand. We've got a Labor government, that it's doing what it should.
Well, Peter, that's because we have official projections and historical records from the Department of Climate Change, Energy and Water, Environment and Water. Those official projections say that we have reduced our emissions from the 2005 benchmark of 612 million tonnes by 29% as of 2025, and that we are within a whisker of being officially on track to achieve 43% reductions by 2030. But the problem with those projections and the reason why they are widely distrusted or criticised is that the largest piece of the reduction it derives from a turnaround in what's called land use change and forestry, which is really goes to stopping clearing new land, although we still do that, but doing it doing less of it, revegetating or reforesting already cleared land, and accounting for that.
Ingrid, what's wrong with the mechanisms we've got? The main one is actually meant to deal with heavy industry. It's called a safeguard mechanism. It applies to about 200 large industrial emitters. Each has to reduce its emissions intensity over time or by offsets. What's wrong with that?
I think there's two parts to your question there, Peter. So the first is to sort of think about the policy mix as a whole, and then we can turn to the safeguard mechanism. So when we think about the policy mix, it just looks at the moment a bit like a patchwork of policies with different policies for different sectors and different facilities.
How many hands would you need to count them? At least two, between one and two, right?
We've How got many
so
have?
Many different policies.
We have a number of policies in place. And that in and of itself is a problem, right? Because it means that we're not applying the same pressure, the same expectation across the economy for all those different facilities and different sectors to reduce emissions. And so that's what, you know, this is why economists would say it's not a very efficient way or a low-cost way to reduce emissions. We have this patchwork of policies, and the centrepiece or the main part of that patchwork is called the safeguard mechanism, which is what you gestured to a second ago. It covers over 200 large industrial sites that emit over 100,000 tonnes of carbon dioxide each year, which adds up to about 30% of Australia's emissions. And the way it works is that the government essentially tailors these emissions intensity baselines for each of those facilities, and they ratchet down through time. So it's very centrally organised as far as policies go. Rather than getting a common price signal across the entire economy, what we have instead is a very centrally planned, quite narrow approach to emissions reduction.
It involves bureaucrats, right? And I'm not wishing to speak ill of those people, but going to each of those sites and saying, look, this is your baseline emissions intensity. We've decided this, or we can have a discussion about it, and then we want you to do this. And they need to do it to every site. So if they expanded it, they need to do it to many, many more, right?
That's right. It gets more complex as you expand it. But in addition to that problem, there is, of course, the fact that it doesn't raise revenue. So it is an emissions reduction policy. It does have the effect of constraining emissions and the costs that that creates through the economy, but it doesn't create any revenue to compensate households for those increases in costs.
Looking across the entire suite of measures, those for energy, for cars, for heavy industry, it could be said that they're a patchwork, they're bureaucratic, and sort of complicated to understand. If you're saying that they're not simple, Ingrid, you're in good company. The former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, who later abolished Julia Gillard's carbon trading scheme, said way back in 2009 that if he had a choice, the measure he would use was a simple carbon tax. He was speaking to Sky News.
I think that the climate change science is far from settled. I also think that if you want to put a price on carbon, why not just do it with a simple tax? Why not ask motorists to pay more? Why not ask electricity consumers to pay more? And then at the end of the year, you can take your invoices to the tax office and get a rebate of the carbon tax you've paid.
That's what he said, Ingrid. Why not just do it with a simple tax? What's the tax you're proposing? You're calling it a polluter pays levy. And what's simple about it?
The polluter pays levy, or the PPL, is a domestic policy, so it applies to Australian carbon emissions. And it's a levy on companies that extract or import fossil fuels based on the carbon embedded in their products. So if we think about extraction in Australia, that's mainly coal and gas. And what you'd be capturing there are the emissions that occur as you actually extract those from the ground. but also downstream emissions. So the easiest way to think about that is if you're a miner who digs a ton of black coal out of the ground, you're responsible for the emissions you generate as you do that, and 2.5 tons of carbon dioxide that's embedded in that ton of black coal. And it covers about 140 sites across Australia where we...
Only 140? Only How many companies?
Our best guess is 60 or fewer companies, and that's where
there are very few collection points.
Very few collection points.
Plus imports, of course, because you'd need, and Europe has this, you'd need a carbon border adjustment mechanism for that.
That's right. So you absolutely have to account for imports, which in the case of fossil fuels for Australia is mainly petrol and diesel. And you'd also want an adjustment at the border for energy intensive products like steel and cement. But the thing is, although it's sort of applied at a very small number of sites, you get remarkable coverage. And that's because nearly 80% of Australia's emissions are from the combustion of fossil fuels. So if you can apply a levy like the PPL really far upstream, so it's, you know, extraction and import, that small number of sites and companies, you get 80% of the economy covered, and actually a little bit more as well as a happy bonus, because you'd be covering those fugitives as well. So it's simple, it's broad, and it raises revenue. It would raise about $22 billion a year on average through to 2050.
How big would the tax be?
We have proposed starting at quite a low price, below about $20. But the idea is that it rises at a steady rate until it meets the price in the European carbon market from 2034. Now, 2034 is the year that the European carbon border adjustment mechanism is applied in full to any energy-intensive products entering Europe. And so at that point, we'd be meeting the European price.
Ingrid, what does the modelling that you've commissioned suggest would happen to emissions under your scheme, compared to at the moment where we're not even getting halfway there?
Compared to current policies, the PPL would more than double emissions reductions in its first decade.
That means we would get almost there?
It would get us nearly all the way to our 2035 target. If you want to think about it in sort of round numbers, after a decade where it's getting progressively deeper cuts compared to current policies, after that decade you're getting about 100 million tonnes of additional reductions each year. From 2036, you're getting an additional 100 million tonnes each year at least of emissions reductions.
What would it do to prices, the prices of petrol, gas, even electricity, and everything we buy that's made from those things?
Well, the levy is applied as far upstream as possible at that point of extraction or import. So the effect would be that it's shared along the supply chain, so between producers and distributors, retailers, and of course, customers. So it will increase prices. Now, it's important to point out, though, any mechanism that reduces emissions will do the same. This is how we reduce emissions, is by increasing the cost of carbon-intensive products. This would do it explicitly, and it would raise revenue. But I think the important thing to think about here is whenever we're weighing up policy options is the question of, well, what is the counterfactual? And the thing is, any policy that drives down our emissions at the speed that we need to land our international targets, is going to have this effect. So that's why we think it's so important to use a large share of PPL revenue to compensate and support households as we go through this transition.
You're proposing giving between all of it to start with and eventually half of it back to the public in lump sum payments every quarter.
Yeah, that's right. So we're putting forward two policies. One's an energy compensation payment, and that's worth on average about $4 billion a year through to 2050.
Leave no one out of pocket. That would be the theory.
That's correct. It's worth about $330 on average through to 2050. It peaks as energy prices peak and things like that. But we have set the amount of compensation at a really generous level so that it exceeds our estimates of household energy bill increases. Now, that's the first component of what we're proposing. But in addition, we're also proposing a household support package that provides additional payments to households that are more exposed to energy-related cost of living concerns. So that would also be worth $4 billion a year for the first decade of the PPL. and we'd propose progressively increasing the value of payments to a progressively smaller share of households. So you could do that with income, for example, and if you were to initially target the bottom, say, 75% of households, that would be an additional payment worth about $490 a year. But if you progressively tightened that targeting and you tapered it off so it was then targeting the bottom 25% of households as you moved through that first decade, that's worth about $1,300 a year to those households.
And you would do this because the bottom 25%, say, of households are those that find us the hardest to escape from higher prices, that can't easily install solar panels.
That's right. So it's designed to do a mix of things to relieve people's concerns about cost of living, which we take incredibly seriously. We understand why people are worried about that, and that's why we've thought really hard about these policies. But it's also, as you say, so how to support households that want to electrify, so to get off gas and to buy an EV instead of a petrol car. But in aggregate, the two packages mean that the vast majority of households will actually be better off under a PPL than they are now.
Ben, we have heard this before. This kind of modelling was done at the time of the Gillard government's carbon price scheme. Are Australians ready to accept higher prices even with compensation? It's not inconceivable that they would. We accepted higher prices when the goods and services tax came in and we got compensation. How do you read the Australian public?
Well, Peter, I think the answer, drawing on the conventional wisdom of the Canberra hardheads, would be a very simple no. It's a foolhardy enterprise. But times do change, as you've pointed out. Conventional wisdom has been proved wrong before, most famously by John Howard and the coalition with the GST, which people did accept.
They'd buried and cremated for a while.
That's right, yeah. But it did. And in fact, it was only 5 years after the Hewson-led opposition was destroyed by a campaign against a proposal for GST. The brief life of the carbon tax is another example, as you pointed out. It didn't seem to upset too many people. It was more a political campaign against it. I don't think we should forget either the long campaign that preceded the Hawke-Keating government's microeconomic reforms of the 1980s and 90s, now fondly recalled as a golden age of reform. And Ross Garnaut and Rod Sims, the people behind the Superpower Institute, were in fact the architects of those reforms, and so they've got a proven track record. I think another factor is Prime Minister Albanese has a record of proving his detractors wrong over the years. They say he's timid, he's also dogged and pragmatic. As Ingrid pointed out, the polluter pays levy starts at a very reasonable price of less than $20 a tonne.
And then it increases.
So, but I think the low start and the generous compensation that comes with it would help a lot. But if it is to match the target of parity with the EU carbon price by 2034, then it would have to ratchet up very quickly because the EU carbon price is €80, or about $130 a tonne now. So you're looking at $15 to $20 a year increase.
It's part of the political problem, and I don't want to sound anti-democracy, but we have elections every 3 years. Julia Gillard lost her job over this scheme. Malcolm Turnbull lost his job as opposition leader over acquiescing to this scheme, not opposing it enough. In order to do that, in order to have a scheme, Ben, that has the carbon price increasing fairly quickly, you need some sort of stability, don't you? You either need an opposition which supports it, as you're quite right to talk about the 80s. It's a myth to say that the opposition supported lots of those Hawke reforms at the time, but that's how we look at it now. You either need an opposition that supports it, or an opposition which is, how can I put this delicately, Ben, as ineffective as the one we have right now on an ongoing basis.
I think the government would need its very best salespeople on the job for this. I don't quite know who they are, but it would need them and quite a bit of luck to go with it as well.
Ingrid, there's something about your scheme that seems odd if you want to build public support for it. You want the government to keep about half of the proceeds and all of the proceeds of a separate, you're calling it fair share levy on gas producers. Why allow so much money to stay in the hands of the government rather than give the lot back to the public?
So just quickly to put the question in some context, the two policies together would be worth an average of $35 billion a year through to 2050. And as you say, in the first decade, we're proposing to give half of the PPL revenues back to households, but that still leaves billions of dollars. So this actually brings us back to a point you made when you opened the program, Peter. You said we have two challenges on our hands. One is reducing emissions and meeting our international commitments, but the other is the state of the economy. We have a budget problem. We're not expected to return to surplus until the mid-2030s, and that means we can't keep spending on things that are important to us, like housing and health and social policy and defence, unless we collect more tax. And so our policies raise a really large amount of money. They do it really efficiently. And we've recommended that a generous share goes back to households. But we haven't tried to tie the government's hands on the rest of the revenue. And that allows governments to prioritise spending across social policies and defence, but also allows the government to pay down the deficit and to strengthen the budget. Because as a general rule, using revenue to strengthen the budget and paying down that deficit is actually deflationary.
You're really trying to kill two birds with one stone, which I suppose is efficiency or productivity, trying to fix the government's financial problems as well as get us back on track to net zero. Efficiency and productivity are what we're about here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National. With me, Peter Martin, our guest this week, carbon pricing and policy lead at the Superpower Institute, Ingrid Burford, and Ben Potter, contributing editor at The Energy. Would we as the public accept such a scheme? Higher prices on everything made with fuel that pollutes. You've commissioned polling. What does it show?
We asked over 3,000 voters what they thought of our proposals. And the polling that was conducted by Redbridge found that 68% had support or, sorry, 68%, I'll start that all again. We undertook polling of over 3,000 voters. That polling was done by Redbridge. And we found that 68% of the voters we spoke to expressed support or strong support for a polluter pays levy. And that support was particularly strong among younger Australians who are making up progressively larger shares of the voting bloc. But it was also high among regional voters in Queensland and New South Wales and Victoria, with 66% support amongst those groups. And maybe, perhaps surprisingly, there was also a high level of support with coalition voters, above 60%.
So we have large support. Was this large support, this 68% support, before they were told that they'd get compensation or just asked about the effect of the tax?
This was just the support that they expressed for requiring a small number of large polluters to pay a levy. Now, of course,
even assuming no compensation, they weren't offered that.
That's correct. And of course, we had extensive discussions and did qualitative research, which, as you'd expect, found that cost of living is absolutely a concern for voters.
Ingrid, presumably you'd get even more than 68% supporting it if they knew they were going to get quarterly compensation payments. Did you present to them the full model that you've actually developed?
We didn't ask them explicitly about that, but it's certainly the logical conclusion if you look at the rest of the polling. The existing support for a polluter pays style levy and concerns about cost of living. So if you combine them, of course, you know, our policy really works to address cost of living concerns while also making sure that polluters pay for their carbon emissions.
Ben, answers to polls are one thing, and how people actually vote, what they'll actually tolerate when prices start increasing, is another thing. Do you think our government could carry the population with it on this in the same way as the European Union has?
It's worth sort of going back to the fundamentals of this proposal. It starts low. It would be, I think, initially pretty hard for consumers to notice anything in their prices. But the government, to pull this off, they'd need extremely skilled salespersonship, and quite a bit of luck.
Ingrid, it's one thing to talk about the costs, and the costs are what the politicians would need to think about, and the political costs of a carbon tax. Those costs need to be compared to the alternative costs, I guess, the alternative costs of whatever else the government would have to do to get to net zero, or the alternative costs of whatever else the government would need to do to repair the budget. What do those alternative costs look like?
Treasury actually modelled what they called a disorderly path to net zero quite recently. It's an excellent description for a policy scenario. And the short version is it's much more costly than a well-managed path to net zero, as you'd expect. And so on the emissions front, we know that if we want to reduce the cost across the economy of reducing our emissions, the best way to do that is a broad-based price where investors and households and consumers can anticipate very clearly what the trajectory looks like, and so they can plan for it. It removes uncertainty as well. And it's crucial that investors' incentives are aligned with our net zero goals. On the revenue front, we need to raise revenue, and tax reform is very much on the agenda at the moment. We had all those tax roundtables last year. One thing that I think we lose in this is that it's much better for the economy to tax something bad, like pollution, than to tax things like income or corporate income.
We shouldn't be taxing goods, and by goods, you're referring to things such as work or things such as investment, the kind of things we want. We should be taxing something we don't want.
Yes. So as an economist, I would say we would like to raise our revenue as efficiently as we can, minimising the costs on the rest of the economy. And so that's why, you know, you said earlier, two birds with one stone. You know, any other emissions reduction policy will be more expensive. Other forms of revenue raising are more expensive. This really is the best policy package that we can come up with that delivers on both those goals and addresses both those challenges.
Ingrid and Ben, who sounds sceptical but hopeful, thank you both so much. And thank you for listening. We want to hear what you think about this suggestion. You can email us at theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. You can find our program on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays and now Saturday mornings. Thanks to both of you, and thanks to producer Hayley Crane. I'm Peter Martin. I'll see you next week.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.